This edition of the Recap was first broadcast on the 25th of July, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs, broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, reflections on the Iran nuclear deal, insight into Yemen's evolving conflict, and coverage of the UK Prime Minister's bid to tackle extremism.
He wants to stand up and say, I've got this problem under scrutiny in case there is another attack.
That's in a highlight from Midori House. Plus, we hear about the most successful South Indian film ever, discuss recent comments by former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, and hear the inner thoughts of our culture editor Robert Bound, as we enjoy his monologue aired on Friday's episode of The Globalist.
I can make no judgments here other than to talk generally about the superhuman crappiness of stealing someone else's idea in a marketplace which is specifically absolutely 99% about ideas.
All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Daniel Giacopelli. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs, broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Now, we start today's show in the UK, where on Monday, Prime Minister David Cameron announced a new five-year plan to fight extremism. He said Britain must act to de-glamorize groups such as Islamic State and do more to promote tolerance, democracy, the rule of law, and freedom of speech. The new measures include allowing parents to have their children's passports cancelled if they suspect them of planning to join a radical group abroad, plus new powers to tackle foreign channels promoting messages of hate and extremist content. On Monday's episode of Midori House, Steve Bloomfield heard the views of former British diplomat John Everard and Sebastian Borger, the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung.
It was a very carefully worded and very well delivered speech. It was a very clear message both to the Islamists and to anybody who might have dealings with them that Cameron is serious about stopping this. In many ways, he simply has repackaged already available measures into a rather grandiose five-year plan. Why 5 years? Why not 10? Why not 15? Anyway, five-year plan to tackle this scourge. One interesting tidbit is that he has said that parents will be able to ask for their children's passport to be cancelled. This is an obscure British constitutional weakness. There is no constitutional guarantee in the United Kingdom of the right to a passport, which means that in certain circumstances, the government can cancel it. Now, you can see that this is the kind of...
Why leave it to the parents? I didn't quite get that.
No, I thought that was odd too. If, for example, the security authorities believe that a child is in danger of running off and joining Islamic State, why can't they step in? But that wasn't actually in the speech.
It sounded positively Soviet, didn't it? All this talk of a five-year plan, very, very, very odd. I completely agree with John. It was a very carefully worded speech. The background was one nation, one United Kingdom, which is interesting because, of course, it quotes his own election campaign. But the measures that he talked about seemed to me slightly sort of plucked out of thin air. I mean, he's saying on the one hand, rightly, I believe, that there are too many kids from actually quite well-to-do families who have had the chance to go to university and get a degree at a UK university and then go off and fight for Daesh, ISIL, whatever you want to call it. On the other hand, he's asking a senior civil servant for help whose speciality is dealing with what is called problem families. In other words, where generations have been on the dole. It doesn't quite fit together.
John, is there also an issue about how this looks in that we're talking about a prime minister from a very posh, comfortable white background, where the only Muslim who's actually been in a David Cameron cabinet at Saeed Awasi has actually said, I disagree with everything he's doing here. There's a danger in how this looks, isn't there?
Can I just say the business secretary, Sajid Javid, is a Muslim, isn't he?
Okay, one out of 23.
Yes, there has been some dissent in his own ranks. What has struck me was the extent to which his remarks have been endorsed by the left in the UK. If you troll through the comments on it in left-wing newspapers in this country, people who have never, as far as I'm aware, ever said anything nice about David Cameron are coming out saying, this was an awesome speech. The themes plucked from the air, you think, Sebastian? I think he's very carefully picked the ones that he knows are going to appeal.
He can deliver.
He can deliver, yes, point one. Point two, are going to command dissent across the political spectrum. Mm. There was a lot of internal politics in this, and he's pitched it just right.
The interesting thing I thought, if you just looked at the speech, it could have been Tony Blair. He's completely copying Tony Blair in the way he talks about the Iraq War. He rejects all this talk of the Jewish conspiracy. He says it wasn't our foreign policy. 9/11 happened before the Iraq War. All of those things. We all heard that from Tony Blair. My feeling was the security services are very nervous. I think that's part of the problem. I think he wants to stand up and say, I've got this problem under scrutiny in case there is another attack.
We don't need to speculate. When the security services have just a couple of weeks ago raised the terror alert, the fact that he calls it a five-year plan indicates that he thinks this is going to go on for quite some time. As I said at the beginning, I said that 5 years was a conservative estimate. Have the rules of the game changed? Essentially, no. He's pointed to existing powers, he's ramped up a few other powers, but nothing really game-changing in there. Just very good presentation.
That was former British diplomat John Everard and also Sebastian Borger, the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, talking to host Steve Bloomfield on Monday's episode of Midori House. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Now, the ink had barely dried on the deal between Iran and Western world powers over Tehran's nuclear program before nations such as Israel and also sections of America's political world condemned it as a gargantuan folly. A week on from the deal, the arguments were deepening over what it would bring to the rest of the world. On Tuesday's episode of The Monocle Daily, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds were joined in the studio by Nahla Ayed, foreign correspondent for CBC, to reflect on whether the deal will hold.
I think you have to remember that no one expected this to be a smooth process. First of all, too much time between the actual agreement and its implementation. There are a million political processes that have to go through, and there are tons of critics out there who not only don't like the deal, but they want to be assuaged over the deal. So the fact that there's criticism, the fact that there's discussion, the fact that there are people at odds is not at all surprising in this stage. And what you're seeing here is not just a defense of the agreement, but also perhaps a defense of what you might call the need to show a commitment to the status quo. The fact that people want to say that, yes, we have a deal, but we still don't have trust with Iran or vice versa with Washington, that this isn't Cuba, this is Iran, and that there aren't going to be U.S. embassies opening in Tehran. And so that's what you're seeing here is just kind of a defense of the status quo as well.
You all got very much the impression that Kerry was in fact defending the United States stance.
It's very interesting what Kerry said, actually. He said something today, in addition to his being disturbed, that he said previously in discussing this exact kind of scenario, and that is what you might hear publicly from a leader in Iran isn't necessarily something that reflects what's going on in policy or happening domestically. During negotiations themselves, he actually said that he was not going to be deterred by things being said by Khamenei or anyone else, that he would only listen to the negotiators in Vienna, because you never knew who the audience was. Khamenei could have been, it's a possibility, strictly speaking to his own audience and talking to those critics, very vocal critics in Iran itself of the deal, who are now coming out and saying, well, this is Iran capitulating, or who might come out in the future and say that this is Iran capitulating, that they don't want to see normalization of relationship with the U.S. So Kerry has said repeatedly that he would not be dissuaded. So as disturbed as he was today, I think he recognizes this may be an internal conversation happening in Iran.
Well, there's an internal conversation going on in the U.S., of course, at the point where America is ramping up to have another election. And that means a lot of people want to have a lot of very loud arguments about this. I mean, there's been lots of condemnation from Republicans in Congress. Can that affect things at this point?
There's no question that this is going to be a very difficult balancing act. And in fact, what's being said in Tehran has echoes in Washington. It has echoes in Israel as well. You will find Obama is going to have to hold many forts as this all goes forward until it is passed by both Iran and the U.S., if it is. That's the expectation. But I think that one thing to remember, though, is that the message the leadership in the U.S. is trying to get across is that, A, this is not Cuba. And while the German finance minister is there as we speak. The French foreign minister is going to visit Tehran next week. The UK is saying they're going to open an embassy by Christmas, that there has been no such move by the US. They have strictly said this is a deal about nuclear power and nothing else, and that normalizing relations is far, far off in the future.
We're talking an awful lot about whoever's voice is being heard the loudest in all this at the moment. When you were in Tehran a couple of weeks ago, this was in the run-up to the deal being struck. Whose voice was being heard the most clearly then?
Very interesting that the loudest voice you could hear then were those who were supportive of the deal. In fact, what struck me most is that people were talking about it at all. In fact, one expert we spoke to said that a few years ago that it was verboten. You could not discuss whether it was a good thing or a bad thing to be fighting on behalf of the nuclear program on the international stage. Two women we stopped on the first day we were there had us there for 15 minutes talking to us about why they did not like the nuclear program, what a big price that Iranians had paid for that program, and that they were done with it. They wanted their leadership to move on. They wanted to strike a deal that would lift the sanctions and improve their lives. One of them was getting married. She said this would help her in the future. And so the discussion was vibrant. The newspapers talked about it. It was headline material every day. The hardliners did not want to be unheard. They did have their rallies. There was one rally that was there while we were there. They had their placards and said, death to America, but they still wanted a good deal. So that's what changed, is the conversation has tilted towards those who want normalized relations with the world.
That was a highlight from Tuesday's episode of The Monocle Daily, where Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds spoke to Nahla Ayed, foreign correspondent for CBC. And now let's head to India, where a new film's been shaking Bollywood's dominance. Director S.S. Rajamouli's film Bahubali, The Beginning, has become the most successful South Indian film ever, proving that an all-India blockbuster hit can come from outside the Hindi-language Bollywood industry. On Tuesday's episode of The Briefing, Marcus Hippie was joined by Samnath Bhatibyal from the Center for Media and Film Studies at SOAS here in London. Before they got talking, they had a listen to the film.
The thing which is taking India by storm now is mythologies, whether it be books, whether it be movies. So this is part of this kind of mythological series, and it's about two estranged brothers. And one of the brothers is good, one is bad. The bad guy has captured the mother and kept her prisoner. The good guy is growing up in a small forest outside the kingdom, in this mythical forest. And finally, of course, he grows up and there's an epic battle in between their loads of love stories and singing and dancing. And in that epic battle, which lasts for about 30 minutes, good prevails over evil.
What's going on over there? Why do you think it has become such a hit?
The main thing to understand here is India's cinegoers now understand the need for good graphics and good visual effects. They see Hollywood films. So this film is particularly striking because of quite spectacular battle scenes. I mean, it's nothing in a sense compared to what Hollywood would offer, say, a film like Troy, even ancient films like Ben-Hur. But it does go to the next level as far as spectacular graphic effects go, and it's comparatively new in Bollywood. They have employed quite a few Hollywood consultants for arranging the sequences, and 25 minutes is a long time. Over 150,000 people were actually involved in the battle scene, so in that sense it was quite epic. But there are a couple of other things, if I may, to introduce to this conversation. Annually, every year during the Eid times, a couple of blockbusters come out. This year, the difference is that it's a South Indian movie which has taken the industry by storm. Though the usual Bollywood Salman Khan movie has also come out, and it's kind of going second best. Usually it's the Salman Khans or the Shah Rukh Khans which dominate. Having said this, it's two bare-bodied men. You know, the structures remain the same. Here is Salman Khan bare-bodied, six-pack, and there's this South Indian gentleman called Prabhas who is huge and big and young and kind of muscular looking, who's picking up 2 tons of Shiva statues and dumping them here and there. So the story structures don't really change. It's just spectacular.
Samnath Bhatibyal from the Center for Media and Film Studies at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies here in London, talking to Marcus Hippie on Tuesday's episode of The Briefing. Up next, we take a look at recent comments by Mikhail Gorbachev. Stay with us.
To celebrate Monocle's inaugural Restaurant Awards, we dispatched our filmmakers to sample breakfast in Toronto, lunch in Fort Edamame, and dinner in Stockholm to discover the alchemy of ingredients shared by this year's winners.
You need to care and enjoy talking to your customers, and you need to make a kind of place where you yourself would eat.
My grandpa had a book of recipe that he wrote, and he always said, why embellish a dish if it's working?
It's family style, it's sharing is caring. It's very simple and straightforward. We write our menus on a weekly basis based on the quality and produce available, and we only work with local suppliers.
Recipes for Success, a trio of restaurants getting it right. You can watch our film by heading to the film section of monocle.com and just press play.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news and discussion shows hosted right here at Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. This week, the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev expressed his concern over the deteriorating relations between the Kremlin and the West. The 84-year-old urged Moscow and Berlin to reestablish trust in an interview for Russian news agency TASS. He stressed there's no time to lose, asking for responsibility and wisdom from both governments. Well, on Wednesday's edition of Midori House, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck heard the views from Shashank Joshi, senior research fellow at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, and Mary Dijewski from the Independent newspaper here in the UK.
I'm not sure that this was a message that was intended for the Russians. To my mind, this is almost one of the most interesting developments that we've seen all day, because it looks to me as though this was an interview for the Russian, basically, state news agency. They decided, somebody to my mind in the Kremlin, possibly right at the very top, decided that they wanted to send a signal, and they looked around desperately for somebody who would carry conviction, especially in former Western Europe and in Germany, because I think the olive branch is sort of extended to Germany. And the person they came up with, quite correctly, for a Western and a European audience, is Gorbachev. And I think it's, in a way, it's the first sign that we've seen. If we go back to the whole sanctions question, the Ukraine question, this is the first sign we've seen, to my mind, that the Kremlin wants an end to this East-West standoff and regards it as dangerous. And I think this reflects a huge change in the Kremlin. And it's sending out a signal that they want to be picked up. And so what I'll be doing in the next few days is waiting to see whether maybe there's some sort of reciprocal signal sent from the other side.
I think it's interesting to see the choice of messenger. Gorbachev, of course, much more liked here than he is in Moscow. I think also, unfortunately, his credibility has been tarnished in the last year as well by his posture towards the issue of the annexation of Crimea, his support for many of Putin's activities. I'm not sure he has quite the same moral authority on these matters that he did 18 months ago, and that's rather a shame, but I think that's down to his own choices. I also think that it's interesting to see how Russia played a very significant role over the last 13 years, but also in the last weeks, on the Iran deal. And it's a very important example of tactical, well, more than tactical, but compartmentalized cooperation on a key issue. That said, I would prefer to see concrete signals in behavior rather than signals that I'm afraid I don't think are worth an awful lot through messengers like this. I would wish to see signals in terms of compliance with Minsk, signals in terms of changes in behavior and many of the other aspects we've been concerned about in terms of Russia. But subject to that, yes, reciprocity, I think, is a desirable and sensible thing.
Mary, on a slightly different tangent, it's quite hard, actually, for, you know, the notion of the elder statesman, the person who could rock up in all different sorts of markets and have influence, there's not many of them left, are there? I guess when you look to the US, like Clinton, who some people would value, Kofi Annan's name often gets mentioned in these circumstances. But do you think there are many elder statesmen who, when you're covering foreign affairs, you think, actually, here is one voice that people would listen to?
You're right. I mean, I think that the whole concept of elder statesman, in a way, it's something that seems rather as though it belongs to the past, and it's very difficult to see, even among today's politicians, who is potentially an elder statesman, you know, maybe Angela Merkel. It depends an awful lot on what happens in the next few years. But I think it's interesting that the Russians wheeled out Mikhail Gorbachev, because it does show, in a way, the dearth of anybody else. And you said that Gorbachev is 84. He's also in pretty bad health. He's sort of in and out of hospital. He's got a heart complaint. This is not an easy thing for him to be asked to do.
Shashin, Carter, Clinton.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Carter obviously has played that role, but he's also played a very activist partisan role in that debate, right? He's been extremely pro-Palestinian, and that in some ways has limited his impact in reaching out to all sides in that particular debate. Clinton has done that, but Clinton occupies an interesting place, a little bit like Tony Blair as well, in that they could have been elder statesmen, but their legacies have not been quite as disinterested and apolitical as they might have wished. You know, Tony Blair's role in the Quartet was not viewed as an elder statesman. It was viewed in comparative scorn, I think. And it's difficult to see from our own polity, who are those elder statesmen for us? Is it John Major, perhaps? I mean, he certainly intervened in the European debate. But if we wish to send a message to our adversaries, whether that's Russia or Iran or someone else, who would we send? It's really elder royals. The royal family plays that kind of strange role for us. There's no one else.
I have to pack off the Queen on the quiet.
Shashank Joshi there from Rusi, and also Mary Dujewski from The Independent here in the UK, talking to Andrew Tuck on Midori House on Wednesday. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. On Wednesday, a military aircraft touched down at Aden International Airport, the first time a plane had landed in the southern Yemeni city since March. Iran-backed Houthi rebels began seizing the area earlier this year, and it was only last week when loyalist fighters, backed by airstrikes from a Saudi-led Arab alliance, managed to get some of it back. The aircraft, a Saudi plane carrying aid, looks set to pave the way for an aerial corridor for deliveries to Yemen's south. Meanwhile, a technical team from the UAE is providing urgent repair work for the airport. For more on this, on Thursday's episode of The Briefing, Monocle's Marcus Hippie spoke to journalist and Yemen specialist Iona Craig.
When I was in Aden last month, it was pretty bad. In fact, the resistance, the supposedly pro-government force there, had claimed they'd taken it back then, and I went to visit it, and sure enough, it was still filled with Houthis, tanks, and the place was pretty decimated. But it doesn't take a huge amount of work to fill in the potholes in the runway that have been created by airstrikes to get a military plane in. It's slightly more complicated for then getting in commercial flights, obviously. The control tower had been destroyed and the terminal buildings had been pretty badly hit as well. But yes, for the military planes, it's pretty straightforward to mend the tarmac and get them in initially.
Well, as you mentioned already, it's not always clear who was in charge over there and what exactly has happened. Houthis still reject claims that they have lost Aden. When you think of, for example, this plane that landed, what kind of security measures does it actually take to land a plane there?
This was a very large military transport plane, and actually in the days before it landed, Saudi special forces had been in on the ground to escort their own officials who'd flown into Aden as well. So it would be quite important, obviously, that the Houthis' heavy weapons are not in range of those planes when they're coming to fly in. And the airport is situated to the north of the city, and the Houthis are still in positions not too far north of the airport. So yes, it would be obviously very crucial to them that missiles and Grad missiles are not within range of those kind of planes trying to come into the city, but they're able to come in from the south by the sea. So, you know, be able to avoid those kind of attacks by the Houthis, because yes, it would be something of a disaster for the Saudis if their planes were being blown out of the sky by the Houthis still from their positions.
How important is that airport now?
It's crucial for two reasons. For the humanitarian aid that you mentioned, there have been virtually no commercial imports into Yemen over the last 4 months. The country imports 90% of its food. So the humanitarian situation is dire right now. So the airport opens up that, as well as using the sea in Aden. But for the Saudis, really, it's on the military front. So it's about being able to bring in more troops, as they have been doing. A lot of them have been Yemeni-trained troops coming back into the city. But weapons and armored personnel carriers that we've been seeing coming into the city in order to continue this ground offensive, which they're now pushing north, and there's been fighting to the east of the city. And the next target really will be the Al Anad airbase, which is where the American special forces were before, and some British special forces, which is crucial to whoever holds the city of Aden. Without it, you're going to struggle to control Aden for too long.
So what kind of flights do you expect to see landing at that airport in the near future?
Well, actually, I spoke to the head of Yemenir, the national state airline, and they're hoping that they will be able to resume some form of flights in the next few days. They said the equipment that's gone in to repair the control tower should make it possible for them to be able to resume flights. And they had been flying into Sana'a a couple of days a week, but all of those flights are still going via Saudi Arabia so that Saudi can check who's on the planes and what's being carried into the country. So Yemen doesn't really have sovereignty over its own airspace at the moment, so it's all in the hands of the Saudis and they decide who gets to go in and out.
That was journalist Iona Craig there talking to Marcus Hippie, who hosted the briefing on Thursday here at Monocle 24. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. It's almost time to go, but first let's hear a highlight from Friday's episode of The Globalist. In that day's monologue, we heard from Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound, who's a little huffed and puffed over people stealing the ideas of others.
Who nicked my idea is one of the eternal post-work pub arguments of the over-refreshed and the underappreciated employee. From the traders who keep their stock tips close to their chests in the square mile by doing deals on a dozen mobile phones lest prying ears eavesdrop their millions away, to the news reporter whose scoop has been scooped by the guy on the next desk, no one likes to have their idea half-inched. Yesterday, the London advertising agency 18 Feet and Rising filed a claim against Nationwide, Britain's leading building society, in the High Court, and it seems that the clash is based on allegedly stolen goods and nicked ideas. 18 Feet were employed by Nationwide between 2011 and this year to dream up campaigns for screen and print. Nationwide's business has been estimated at being worth £30 million a year. It seems possible that one of the last campaigns pitched to the building society before it relieved 18 Feet of its services was one similar enough to the cosy story of a boy and a scarf currently playing on TV screens for the agency to take the building society to court. I can make no judgments here other than to talk generally about the superhuman crappiness of stealing someone else's idea in a marketplace which is specifically absolutely 99% about ideas. In fact, it's like working in a building society and stealing from customers' savings accounts. Sure thing, it's wrong, but it's also such bad news and bad publicity. Building societies like to present themselves as the friendly face of a financial sector full of snakes, tax havens, and wolves of Wall Street. Much of the folklore they like their agencies to spin for them is based on trust, familiarity, belonging to a family. Adverts tend to include scenes of handsome, rustic types, giving the very salt of the earth a run for its salty earthiness. There are sentimental homecomings to parlours, sons having their hair ruffled by caring, chunky-sweated fathers, the overcoming of small fears, coming of age, smiling at bonfires. Yup, there's a shitload of cliché, but then this is Adland, in which rearranging the rudiments of familiarity is stock in trade. Only the judgment in the High Court will decide what happens in this case, of course, but the story of advertising agencies having their creative stolen for it to turn up in a suspiciously similar format for the client in question is not new. Anyone with an interest in ideas and who owns them should watch this case with interest. All that without mentioning David or Goliath. Until now. For Monocle in London, I'm Robert Bound.
Just one of our many daily monologues there that you can enjoy by tuning into The Globalist each weekday at 7 a.m. London time. And that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. This show is produced by Alice Block and edited by Weidong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Daniel Giacopelli, thanks for listening. Goodbye.